Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, January 10th, 2023. The new U.S. House Republican majority votes to create two new investigative committees, one titled The Weaponization of the Federal Government, looking at actions and investigations at the Justice Department, FBI, and intelligence community, including those targeting former President Donald Trump. The other committee focusing on U.S. competition with China, or more specifically, according to the authorizing resolution, the Chinese Communist Party. Republican and Democratic lawmakers reacting today to the news that some classified documents were found in an office used by Joe Biden after he left the vice presidency. Even as the 118th Congress just getting started, some concerns about later in the year when federal spending bills need to be signed into law to avoid a government shutdown, and what House Speaker Kevin McCarthy may have promised some conservative members of his own party to get their votes for Speaker. And the latest with President Biden at the North American Leaders Summit in Mexico City, joining the President of Mexico and the Prime Minister of Canada, we'll talk with Vox senior political reporter Christian Paz. And we start with the House of Representatives and a resolution to create a subcommittee on the weaponization of the federal government. That's the official title given to it by the Republican majority. Political rights, it's a broad mandate that will allow the party to look into any government agency or program that if used as suspect, including the FBI, IRS, and the intelligence community, making good on a key demand of a band of hardline conservatives who oppose Speaker Kevin McCarthy's bid for the gavel. There's also this from an NBC News article saying the subcommittee could serve as a one-stop shop for investigating perceived wrongdoing by the federal government against conservatives, including former President Donald Trump. The subcommittee would be under the Judiciary Committee, and the full committee chair is Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio. He's also expected to chair this subcommittee. Jim Jordan spoke on the House floor today during the debate. He followed a Democrat who called the new subcommittee a ploy.
It's not a ploy when the Department of Justice treats parents as terrorists, moms and dads who are simply showing up at a school board meeting to advocate for their son or daughter. A ploy. It's not a ploy when the FBI pays Twitter $3 million, not one, not two, $3 million to censor American citizens. It's not a ploy when the Department of Homeland Security tries to set up a disinformation governance board, because we all know that the Department of Homeland Security can tell what's good speech and what is bad speech, what's mis— I mean, you got to be kidding me. I tell you what, dozens of whistleblowers have come talk to Republican staff on the Judiciary Committee, don't think this is a ploy. That's why they came to talk to us. They know how serious this is. The former Democrat chair of the Judiciary Committee is in the press today saying, we're going to fight this tooth and nail. This is political. But meanwhile, the former Democrat chair of the Intelligence Committee pressured Twitter to censor a journalist. You've got to be kidding me. That this is the most important. This is about the First Amendment, something you guys used to care about. And I'd actually hoped we could get bipartisan agreement on protecting the First Amendment, the five rights we enjoy as Americans under the First Amendment. Your right to practice your faith, your right to assemble, right to petition the government, freedom of press, freedom of speech. Every single one's been attacked in the last 2 years. Government was telling people they couldn't go to church just a few years ago. Your right to assemble, your right to petition the government. The Democrats kept the Capitol closed. You couldn't, as a citizen, couldn't come to your Capitol that you pay for to address your member of Congress, to redress your grievances, because Nancy Pelosi wouldn't let you in. Freedom of the press, I just told you what the head of the Intel Committee tried to do to a journalist. The most important right we have, though, is your right to talk. Because if you can't talk, you can't practice your faith. You can't share your faith. You can't petition your government. The right to speak is the most important, and that's what they're going after. And that's why we've had dozens of whistleblowers come talk to us. We want to focus on that because we want it all to stop. We want the double standard to stop. This idea that if you're a pro-life activist, you're going to get your door kicked in, you're going to get arrested and handcuffed in front of your 7 kids and your spouse for simply praying in front of an abortion clinic and telling the guy who was harassing your son to knock it off. You're going to have the FBI raid your home. But the protest that went on at Supreme Court justices' homes in the aftermath of the leak of the Dobbs opinion, oh, no problem there. Americans are sick and tired of it. And what we want, we don't want to go after anyone. We just want it to stop. And we want to respect the First Amendment to the Constitution that the greatest country in the world has. That's what this committee is all about. And that's what we're going to focus on. That's what we're going to do. And I yield back to the gentleman. Appreciate him.
Congressman Jim Jordan, Republican from Ohio, on the House floor on this resolution to create this new subcommittee. Jim Jordan chairs the full Judiciary Committee. This would be a subcommittee under that committee, and Jim Jordan expected to chair the subcommittee as well. Opposing the resolution, Congressman Gerald Nadler, Democrat from New York, former chair of the Judiciary Committee, now ranking member.
Mr. Speaker, I rise in strong opposition to this resolution, which appears designed to launch a dangerous and unprecedented attack on our law enforcement agencies. Last week, Americans across the country watched the Republican Party melt down the moment it encountered its first test. For days, the extremist wing of the party held the rest of their caucus hostage as they demanded a steep price for their support. And today, we have the first of their many demands on display, an open-ended investigation into whatever conspiracy theories may be headlining the right-wing echo chamber at the moment, with unchecked authority to undermine ongoing criminal and intelligence investigations. For example, the Select Committee can use its expansive authorities to protect Donald Trump, those who perpetrated fake elector schemes to overturn the 2020 presidential election, insurrectionists facing trials for their crimes, and other domestic terrorists. It aims to undermine the safeguards of our democracy and to embolden MAGA extremists who would rather see our institutions fail than to see Democrats and President Biden succeed. Make no mistake, the Destroy Democracy Subcommittee will enable the House Republicans to interfere with the free operation of businesses they do not like, to inhibit the fight against domestic terrorism, and to settle political scores on behalf of Donald Trump. The Judiciary Committee has serious work to do, but rather than trying to solve the problems of the American people, this new subcommittee will expend untold time and money undermining our nation's law enforcement agencies, our justice system, and our intelligence community, all for a political stunt catering to the extremist wing of the Republican Party. I oppose this resolution, and I encourage my colleagues to do the same, and I yield back the balance of my time.
Congressman Gerald Nadler, Democrat from New York, on the House floor. The House went on to pass this resolution, creating this new subcommittee, by a vote of 221 to 211, it was party line, Republicans voting yes, all Democrats voting no. One of the investigations being done by the Justice Department that concerns former President Donald Trump is the handling of classified documents found at his home in Mar-a-Lago, Florida, documents that were recovered by the FBI after a standoff over a subpoena for them. Now lawmakers on Capitol Hill reacting to the news this week that some classified documents were discovered at a private office used by Joe Biden when he left being vice president and became an honorary professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Joe Biden's personal attorneys finding the documents in November when packing up files, notifying the White House counsel and notifying the National Archives and Records Administration to turn those documents over. Justice Department has named a U.S. attorney in Chicago to review this matter. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, asked about it this morning outside the regular Tuesday private meeting of House Republicans on Capitol Hill.
Congresswoman, do you have a message about the documents found at the Penn Biden Center?
This is a very serious situation. Vice presidents cannot declassify documents, and the fact that Joe Biden is in possession of classified documents when he was vice president signals that we need to have a serious investigation into this. And there's a true two-tiered justice system stemming from Merrick Garland's Department of Justice and the way that President Trump has been treated, who is allowed to classify and declassify documents. Presidents can do that versus the Democrats and Joe Biden and how he's being treated. I'll echo again. impeach Biden, and that's what we need to do.
And what do you make of the timing of this? The documents were found in early November, do you think?
Yeah, that's a, well, it's a bunch of BS.
Thank you, Congresswoman.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, speaking to reporters on Capitol Hill. Vice President, former Vice President Mike Pence also weighing in, calling for a special counsel to look into the documents found at Joe Biden's former private office, similar to the special counsel named by the Justice Department to handle the classified documents found at the home of former President Donald Trump. Congressman Pete Aguilar, Democrat from California, is the House Democratic Caucus chair and a former member of the now defunct House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Congressman Aguilar asked at a House Democratic leadership news conference about those classified materials found at the office used by Joe Biden.
Chairman Aguilar, Adrian Abias with CBS News. Should the discovery of President Biden's classified documents been disclosed before the midterms?
Well, let's step back and talk about this for a minute, because, and I appreciate the question, this is Republican hypocrisy at its finest. When the former president had 320 documents found at his personal residence, they said that, quote, that will not be a priority. What President Biden did was disclose this to the archives, let law enforcement know. That is exactly the way that you should handle this. So we're going to support the fact that the president is following this established protocol, that he did the right thing, and see where we go from here. But we're not interested. Republicans aren't interested in having meaningful oversight. They're just interested in opposing this president.
What do you say to critics who argue these documents were discovered November 2nd, midterms were November 8th, and they could have been withheld to avoid potential damage against Democrats before the midterms?
This was done in consultation. You saw Merrick Garland have a U.S. attorney weigh in at this point. This is being done the exact way, getting the archives involved, someone who was on the January 6th committee. There is a process to handling documents. The president is handling it the way he should. That's what's important. Go ahead.
To follow up on that, though, I mean, in April, we knew about the search warrant executed at Mar-a-Lago. Isn't that sort of a time when everybody goes, let's just make sure we don't have any of our own? Isn't this a little bit sloppy to not have this go through things on the Democrat side to make sure that when they're saying this is terrible, he has documents, let's also make sure that we don't have any documents?
I don't think that's a question for me. That might be a question directed down the street. But what I'll tell you is this is being done. This is being handled the way he should. This is not about August. This is about, you know, today, you know, where we are at. The president is handling this the way that he should. He's disclosing it. He's letting the archives know. Law enforcement is aware. We're handling this with the seriousness at which it deserves. But we're not downplaying this, which is exactly what House Republicans have done.
Congressman Pete Aguilar, Democrat from California, the House Democratic Caucus Chair, formerly on the House January 6th Committee, at a news conference today. Associated Press writing, the top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee has requested that the U.S. intelligence community conduct a damage assessment of potentially classified documents found in the Washington office space of President Joe Biden's former institute. Congressman Mike Turner sent the request Tuesday to the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, saying that Joe Biden's retention of the documents put him in, quote, potential violation of laws protecting national security, including the Espionage Act and Presidential Records Act. This is Washington Today. A story from The Hill, the senior Democrat on the powerful House Appropriations Committee is warning that government shutdowns are all but inevitable if the newly empowered Republicans insist on dropping federal funding back to 2022 levels, as some conservatives have demanded. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut, said, I think this notion that you can deal with 2022 levels that appears to have been part of this secret deal, you then may be looking at guaranteeing a shutdown. The Hill article goes on, the secret deal was a reference to the concessions made by Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, to his conservative detractors in order to win their support for his speakership bid, a process that handed him the gavel in the early hours of Saturday morning on the 15th ballot. Well, Congresswoman DeLauro was part of today's House Democratic Leadership News Conference.
Caitlin with Politico.
how do you plan to appropriate around this handshake agreement to set spending levels at fiscal 2022 levels? I mean, presumably, at the very least, we'll need a CR, which would maybe be at fiscal 23 levels. So how do you, you know, plan to actually get this, fund the government, get this done, avoid, you know, a terrible shutdown, and work around what McCarthy's promised conservatives?
Well, I think that my point is that you cannot pass appropriations bills without them being both bipartisan and bicameral. So the president will not sign. So I think this notion that you can deal with 2022 levels, it appears to have been part of this secret deal, that you then may be looking at guaranteeing a shutdown. We will operate in the way that we have, bill by bill, with the issues that are important to us. I think it's very interesting to note that in a divided government, last December, you may recall, we passed an omnibus bill, a bipartisan omnibus bill. 9 Republican votes in the House, and I think close to 19, somewhere around that, in the Senate. So we were able to govern. The issue is going to be is whether or not the Republican majority can govern. But we are going to, as I say, we will work together, we will cooperate, but we are not backing off the critical investments that have been made, that will continue to be made, because someone traded away the well-being of the American public and our national security for personal gain, for a vote. No way to run a government, and no way to govern.
Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, now ranking Democrat on the Appropriations Committee, former chair, speaking at a news conference today. House Republican leaders holding their own news conference. The House Majority Leader Steve Scalise, Republican of Louisiana, asked about another part of the reported agreement between Speaker Kevin McCarthy and those conservative Republican members to get their votes for Speaker. And that is using an expected vote this year to raise the debt ceiling as an opportunity to cut spending, which, if the Democratic-controlled Senate and White House don't agree, could risk the federal government defaulting on its debt for the first time in history.
What has been agreed to on the debt ceiling specifically? There seems to be some confusion. And can you guarantee that the U.S. public will not be called on our debt?
Well, let's first make very clear why the debt ceiling gets hit. And I think this is an important education process to have now and an important conversation to have now, because we haven't hit the debt ceiling yet. But America, over time, occasionally hits the debt ceiling because it's like a credit card limit. And families back home have, if they have credit cards, they have a limit on that credit card. And if they hit their limit or they're very close to it, which we are, it means you've spent more money than you have. You've spent more money than your credit card has allowed you to spend. And if you're going to ask for an increase in the limit, at some point in time, you've got to sit down and say, why are we hitting the limit? Why are we maxing out the credit card? Because this is the nation's credit card. And frankly, it's not us, but next generations that are going to have to pay this. Debt is not something that's just innocuous. It's going to ultimately have to be paid by somebody, and that's future generations. And so if the country is spending more money than we have, and it's trillions of dollars, by the way, and Joe Biden, you saw, trillions and trillions of dollars in bills to rack up debt, that ultimately somebody's going to have to pay. There is no free lunch. And so if we're about to max out the credit card, then before we hit that limit, shouldn't we have an honest conversation about how to start living within our means, how to make sure we're not spending money that we don't have before that comes up? And when that comes up, at the same time you're dealing with the debt limit, you ought to also put in mechanisms in place so that you don't keep maxing it out. Because if the limit gets raised, you don't go to the store the next day and just max it out again. You start figuring out how to control the spending problem. And this has been going on for way too long, and we're going to confront this, and I think the American people have called on us to confront this problem.
Congressman Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana, the majority leader of the House at a news conference today. The Senate Appropriations Committee Chair, Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington State, and the ranking Republican on the committee, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, putting out a joint statement pledging to work together on government funding this year. They write, "We take our responsibility to govern seriously and look forward to working in a bipartisan way here in the Senate to find common ground and move our country forward. There are so many pressing challenges our nation faces right now, both here at home and abroad, and it is our responsibility as members of Congress to do the hard work, to listen to one another, find common ground, and then reach sensible solutions that can help the American people." This story from Fox News: Republicans in the House of Representatives will vote on a bill that would abolish the Internal Revenue Service, eliminate the national income tax, and replace it with a national consumption tax. Fox News Digital has learned that the House will be voting on Georgia Republican Congressman Buddy Carter's reintroduced Fair Tax Act that aims to reel in the IRS and remove the national income tax as well as other taxes and replace them with a single consumption tax. The Fox story goes on, the vote on the bill was made as part of the deal between House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and members of the House Freedom Caucus and was pushed forward in his quest for the gavel. Wall Street today, the Dow up 186, NASDAQ up 106 points, S&P up 27. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell emphasizing today the importance of the Fed's power of independence to act in sometimes unpopular ways to, for instance, bring down high inflation to keep the economy healthy. But Chair Powell also saying that the Federal Reserve should not abuse that power of independence by venturing into other areas best left to elected officials accountable to voters, such as promoting a green economy.
It is essential that we stick to our statutory goals and authorities, and that we resist the temptation to broaden our scope to address other important social issues of the day. Taking on new goals, however worthy, without a clear statutory mandate, would undermine the case for our independence. In the area of bank regulation, as Tobias mentioned, the Fed has a degree of independence, as do the other federal bank regulators. Independence in this area helps ensure that the public can be confident that our supervisory decisions are not influenced by political considerations. And today, some analysts ask whether incorporating into bank supervision the perceived risks associated with climate change is appropriate, wise, and consistent with our existing mandates. Addressing climate change seems likely to require policies that would have significant distributional and other effects on companies, on industries, on regions, and on nations. Decisions about policies to directly address climate change should be made by the elected branches of government and thus reflect the public's will as expressed through elections. At the same time, in my view, the Fed does have a narrow but important responsibilities regarding climate-related financial risks. These responsibilities are tightly linked to our responsibilities for bank supervision. The public reasonably expects supervisors to require that banks understand and can appropriately manage their material risks, including the financial risks of climate change. But without explicit congressional legislation, it would be inappropriate for us to use our monetary policy or supervisory tools, for example, to promote a greener economy or to achieve other climate-based goals. We are not, and we will not be, a climate policy maker.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell at a panel discussion in Stockholm, Sweden, with the leaders of some other central banks. The Federal Reserve has raised interest rates so far 7 times for a total of 4.25 percentage points to deal with high inflation, and is expected to raise the benchmark rate again at their next meeting February 1st. The World Bank's annual report out today warning the global economy will grow by just 1.7% this year and will come perilously close to a recession. World Bank's prediction for U.S. growth is 0.5%. This is Washington Today. Supreme Court hearing a case today involving a concrete company in Washington state that claims when its union workers, its drivers of the trucks, went on strike in 2017, they left wet concrete to harden, and the union should be responsible for the $100,000 in losses. The question to the court is whether the company, Glacier Northwest, can sue the union, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, in state court, or if such claims are prohibited by the federal law called the National Labor Relations Act. Here is some of the oral argument. Justice Sonia Sotomayor questioning company attorney Noel Francisco.
When it comes to destruction of property, I always thought you needed a duty that you're breaching. If an employee goes on strike, their duty to you has ended. I can walk by your plant and the parking lot and see those trucks running. I have no obligation to tell you there's cement in there. I have no obligation to move the truck. I have no obligation to do anything. That's what the employees at that moment, they went on strike. What the government is saying, however, is intentional destruction of property means that I'm taking an affirmative act, not just merely the property perishing on its own. So I don't know why you're answering Justice Kagan. You want something further. You're saying you as an employee have to continue an employment duty with me until all of my profits are safe. That's what I see.
Not in the slightest am I suggesting that, Your Honor. Here, the employees took affirmative action, the union took affirmative action to put the product in a vulnerable position precisely so that
they could
abandon it to spoil.
But you're saying, could a state tell the union, don't go on strike except at the end of the day?
No, Your Honor, what I'm saying is
that what's the difference between that and saying, don't go on strike while the truck has cement that you can offload if you want. You can hire people to offload it. You can do what you did. And it's your property. The moment I walked out on strike, I didn't owe you a duty to protect your property from self-perishment.
So it's the same principle that would prevent the ferry boat crew from driving the boat into the middle of the river and then
on
strike.
Because that's very different in that you have no opportunity to save that property. But here, that's not the case. Here, you'd want them to continue working.
That most manifestly is the case here, Your Honor. Once the
What do we do with the NLRB case of the cheese people that left in the middle of the cheese processing? So the cheese disappeared.
A couple of responses. First,
or
in that case,
flour
there was
delivery or any other perishment of a
property. Yeah, so first, in that case, there was no allegation of an intent to destroy property. If I recall,
the intent is leaving.
Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor questioning attorney Noel Francisco, former Solicitor General during the Trump administration, in the oral argument in the case today, Glacier Northwest Incorporated versus International Brotherhood of Teamsters. We've got the full audio, runs about an hour and a half, at our website, cspan.org. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. President Joe Biden finishing up the two-day North American Leaders Summit in Mexico City with the Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador and the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Some of the issues discussed: immigration and border security, fentanyl smuggling, trade, and clean energy. One of the meetings today was a bilateral one between President Biden and Prime Minister Trudeau.
Mr. Prime Minister, it's great to see you here. When we talked at the G20, we talked about partners, but to increase our coordination, and that's something that that we're going to do. I think your phrase was, when we work together, we can achieve great things, and I believe that. I know the American press is tired of hearing me say this, but I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic about the future and the near term, and it's going to be hard, but there's a lot we can do together. And the fact is, we've been partners and friends. We're NATO partners. We're involved in the North American Leaders Summit. Today, we're going to be going over and seeing our counterpart, the President of Mexico. But I think what we should be doing, and we are doing, is demonstrating the unlimited economic potential that we have when we work together and in the hemisphere, and to help the entire hemisphere. There's a lot we're going to be talking about, including clean energy. We should be the clean energy powerhouse of the world. That's not hyperbole. I genuinely mean that. And we're also in a situation where we're in the process at home, and you are as well. We've talked about it. strengthening our supply chains so that no one can arbitrarily hold us up or a pandemic in Asia cause us to not have access to critical elements that we need to do everything from build automobiles to so many other things. And together, I think we're achieving some really significant things. Today, we're going to discuss how we can try to help stabilize Haiti, how we can deal with migration, and at the same time, bolster our national security. So I want to thank you again. You've always been there whenever I've called. You picked up the phone. I always think it's the same here. I don't think we have, as I told one foreign leader who was with a different perspective than you and I have on world peace, and I said to him, I said, well, I'm lucky. I got Canada north and Mexico to the south and two oceans on either side. You've got, and I described his circumstance. And he just looked at me like, but it's true. We got to make the most of it. And so thank you for everything.
Thank you, Joe. It's so good to be able to spend a little time with you here on some more local issues. You and I have been working so closely on significant global issues, whether it's the pressures of China and Russia and Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine and the need to continue to stand up strong for democracy, for the rule of law, for opportunities and inclusive economic growth around the world. But as you say, there are tremendous things that we can build on here at home. North America is the largest free trading bloc in the world, larger even than the European Union. We have a tremendous amount to contribute to the world in goods and services that the world really needs. And our capacity to work together has brought us to places of extraordinary success. But at a time of disruption around the world, a time of very real challenges, we can and must be doing even more. So I'm really pleased with all the work that our folks have been doing over the past many months and years on aligning, on coordinating, so that we're leading the way on the net zero transition we all have to do, while at the same time ensuring that individual Canadians and Americans and Mexicans and others around the world can see themselves in the future in an optimistic way and understand that, yes, we're at a time of challenges and strife, but you're right, there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic, especially for those of us in our countries. But it's going to take a lot of work, something that neither you nor I nor mostly our citizens have ever been afraid of. Rolling up our sleeves and building that better future in those better communities is absolutely essential. So as we talk about issues, whether it's Haiti, whether it's some of the challenges in South America, whether we talk about critical minerals and energy and how we're going to continue to move forward to create those efficient and resilient supply and value chains that we need, there's a lot that we're going to be able to do together.
More now on President Biden's trip to Mexico City for the North American Leaders Summit. Joining us on the phone is Christian Paas, senior political reporter with Vox. Thank you so much. What has been on the agenda at this summit, and what do the leaders say has been accomplished?
Definitely. I think there are three big things that the White House was preparing reporters and the public to come out and be the main subjects of these meetings. So yesterday, President Biden met directly with President Andrés Manuel López Obrador from Mexico to talk specifically about trade between the two countries and making sure that Mexico and the U.S. are both living up to their agreements on energy policy and investment under the USMCA trade agreement. The second is migration, the record numbers of border crossings that have been happening in the last year, especially since the pandemic ramped up, that Mexico is quick to point out aren't largely made up of Mexican nationals, but of other nationals from other South American and Central American countries that are coming into the U.S. through Mexico, and cooperation on what Mexico can do to both move and expel some of those migrants from Mexico itself or to help with processing of asylum claims and at the southern border with the U.S. And then the third has to do with the flow of fentanyl and narcotics into the U.S. through Mexico, specifically through the powerful drug cartels that still control vast parts of Mexico and control this flow of opioids into the U.S. It's a huge national security concern, given how many tens of thousands of Americans are dying because of overdoses, because of powerful synthetic drugs that are flowing into the U.S. actually at official ports of entry, at border crossings, not necessarily across vast expanses of the southern border. So those are the three big things that the U.S. and Mexico wanted to talk about, and today they are joined by Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, to talk more about climate, to talk about green energy and investment there. And, one of the other things that is kind of flying under the radar is the situation in Haiti, which there's been a lot of violence, a lot of political uprisings. The government there hasn't been able to function, and there's discussion about what these three North American countries might do if it comes to assisting Haiti and helping the country get back on track. Those are the kind of big line items, and there have been some results already. The White House sent out a press release this morning listing some of the things that President Biden has been trying to promote when it comes to semiconductor supply chains, making sure that the North American region is reliant on itself and not necessarily reliant on other countries like China specifically. And then a little bit on investment in electric vehicles, reducing methane emissions to combat the climate crisis, and then agreements on migration and making sure that human rights are respected, and balancing that with the political need, especially in the U.S., to make sure that the southern border is secure, and that people aren't making that treacherous journey to enter the U.S., and making sure that those root causes, which has been something that President Biden, especially as vice president, was very, very focused on, root causes of migration, are addressed, and that's economy, security, opportunities, and making sure that that is a possibility south of the border.
You have an article at Vox.com where you say that the issues that are front and center, like drug trafficking and immigration and border security, are really part of an underlying issue about the sustainability of democracy in the Americas. What do you mean by that?
Yes, definitely. So those big things that we just talked about, root causes of a lot of instability and distrust in government and distrust in institution can be amplified, can be worsened by populism, populist leaders, by anti-democratic tendencies, by the absence of the rule of law, and by impunity, especially in Mexico. So what I talk about in the piece is the fact that there are some issues that deal with President López Obrador, specifically in Mexico's treatment of other branches of government, of independent agencies, of journalists, of civil society, protesters, and immigrants too, that raise concerns here in the U.S., should raise concerns for anyone who cares about human rights, who cares about free speech, who cares about being able to be a functioning democracy, that President Biden should be raising directly with the president of Mexico, but isn't likely to talk about publicly. And the fact that these issues with, what I call an anti-democratic lean or slide in Mexico because of Andrés Manuel López Obrador's tendency to shut down critics and to obfuscate reality and to hide truth and statistics occasionally, kind of point to some of these larger issues in the Americas when it comes to how healthy democracy is and how much people trust in their leaders, trust in institutions, trust that their government and that democracy is working for them. We saw it last week in the Americas, both in the very visible response from right-wing protesters in Brazil who stormed and occupied the Brazilian Congress and Supreme Court and presidential office. And then we saw another example in Mexico a little earlier of some of the violence that sparked after the Mexican military arrested the son of one of the country's most famous drug traffickers, El Chapo, and his son Ovidio Guzman was arrested in the state of Sinaloa. And there was just violence that erupted across that state. The Mexican military was in open conflict with drug cartels, and it kind of just shows the power of drug cartels still in Mexico and their ability to create insecurity, to create doubt in the government's strength, despite the populist support that the president has in Mexico. And these are amplified by state of the economy, by migration, are both amplified and contribute to. And so it becomes a feedback loop, self-reinforces, one issue reinforces the other. And so those are some of the issues that President Biden could take an opportunity to talk to the Mexican president about to recommit the region to democratic values, to support for peaceful protests, to support for journalists. But that isn't likely to be a very public part of this trip. So some of the experts that I spoke to, experts on the region and experts in Mexico, said that it kind of shows the trade-off that President Biden has to handle here, where he needs Mexico to make concessions and continue to work to cooperate on drug trafficking and on immigration. But part of that requires him to talk about democracy and talk about security and talk about prosperity and opportunity. But to do that risks irritating or angering the Mexican president and kind of spoiling some of the constructive work that they want to do on this trip. So it's a delicate balance.
Christian Paz, senior political reporter with Vox. His stories at Vox.com and on Twitter at RealCPaz. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
U.S. House of Representatives today voting to create a new select committee on U.S.-China relations. The official name is the Select Committee on the Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party. And according to the resolution, it will have the authority to investigate and submit policy recommendations on the status of the Chinese Communist Party's economic, technological, and security progress and its competition with the United States. The House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, supported the resolution, spoke on the House floor today during the debate, and assured Democrats that the intent is bipartisan.
You have my word and my commitment. This is not a partisan committee. This will be a bipartisan committee that is my hope, my desire, my wish that we speak with one voice, that we focus on the challenges that we have. How do we bring our jobs back from China to America? How do we secure our intellectual property? How do we make sure our farmland is protected? All of that would be brought up within this committee. The threat is too great for us to bicker with ourselves. The future should be determined by us. I've heard my colleagues on both sides say that the threat posed by Communist China is serious. I fully agree. This is an issue that transcends our political parties. And creating the Select Committee on China is our best avenue for addressing it. If you want to end our dependence on China, this committee will investigate it. You want to protect our national security? This committee will work on it. If you want to stop the theft of intellectual property and bring supply chains back to America, this committee will work to make it happen. Worried about Chinese propaganda in our schools and lobbying efforts in Washington, this committee will shine a bright light on it. Outraged that the CCP is buying American farmland, this committee will work to stop it. But they'll stop it with one voice. It's not one party saying it. It's America united, determining our own future. We want to stop trillions of American dollars from financing communist genocide and military modernization. The committee will work to prevent it, including by investigating how ESG benefits the CCP. The Select Committee on China will create the plan that will take us where we really need to go. It will get us all on the same page and move us in the right direction.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican, on the House floor on this resolution to establish the Select Committee regarding China. One of the Democratic members who voted no, Judy Chu of California.
As chair of the Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus, or KPAC, I rise to address the creation of this Select Committee on the strategic competition between the U.S. and the Communist Party of China. KPAC strongly supports strengthening our economy and national security, and we have always recognized that there are legitimate concerns with the actions of the government of the People's Republic of China. This committee could address these issues productively. However, I rise to remind all members that this committee should not be used as an open invitation to traffic in blatant xenophobic anti-China rhetoric that we know results in physical violence against Asian Americans. We certainly saw this with Trump's labeling of COVID as the China virus, resulting in 11,500 hate crimes against AAPIs in this country. This committee cannot be used to promote policies that result in the racial profiling of Asian Americans, but should directly focus on specific concerns related to the government of the People's Republic of China. We know the danger for Asian American communities if the committee devolves into xenophobic rhetoric and scapegoating. Back in the 1980s, when the economic competition between the U.S. and Japan reached a boiling point, Vincent Chin was out at a bar in Detroit celebrating his upcoming wedding when two laid-off auto workers shouted, "It's because of you that we lost our jobs." These men harassed Vincent, chased him, and bashed him in his head with a baseball bat, beating him until he died. Neither of them served a day in jail and only paid a $3,000 fine. Instead of attending his wedding, Vincent's family attended his funeral. This is part of our country's history. And what this shows is what we say and how we say it matters. And we know how dangerous the consequences can be if we don't get this right.
Congresswoman Judy Chu, Democrat from California, on the House floor. She was one of 65 Democrats voting no on this resolution creating the Select Committee, but 146 Democrats in the House did vote yes, joining Republicans. So it passed with 365 votes to that 65. The expected chair of the Select Committee is Congressman Mike Gallagher, Republican from Wisconsin. An update on Ukraine's fight against Russia's military invasion. The Pentagon announcing today that Ukrainian soldiers will begin training on the Patriot air defense missile system as soon as next week at Fort Sill in Oklahoma. The U.S. announced it was sending Ukraine that Patriot system in late December when the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, visited Washington, D.C. and met with President Joe Biden at the White House. From the Pentagon briefing room, here's the press secretary, Pat Ryder.
I can confirm that training for Ukrainian forces on the Patriot air defense system will begin as soon as next week at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The training will prepare approximately 90 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers to operate, maintain, and sustain the defensive system over a training course expected to last several months. And once fielded, the Patriot will continue to contribute to Ukraine's air defense capabilities and provide another capability to the Ukrainian people to defend themselves against Russia's ongoing aerial assaults. We'll be sure to provide additional information as it becomes available.
Pentagon Press Secretary and Air Force Brigadier General Pat Ryder in the Pentagon briefing room. CNN reports that Fort Sill is one of the Army's four basic training locations and home to the service's Field Artillery School, which has been training service members for more than a century. Also this at the CNN article, though the Patriot is broadly seen as one of the most advanced and effective air defense systems, experts caution that it is not a game changer because of its limited range and the amount of time it will take for Ukrainians to be able to utilize it. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. You can subscribe at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.